The date is October 8, 2008. We are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing James B. Osborne, born April 30, 1938, in Aiken, South Carolina. My name is James McCannell, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Frank Reidinger, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. James, tell us what your period of service was, please.
I was in the U.S. Army between May 1st, 1961, and April 30, 1963.
Okay, and during which conflict did you serve?
Well, no conflict other than the Cold War.
Okay, and what was your rank attained?
James? When I went in, I was a second lieutenant. When I got out, I was a first lieutenant.
Okay, and where did you serve?
Initially, I started at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I was there for about 6 months. Then things heated up in Germany, and the Berlin Wall was built, and a bunch of us were sent to Germany. So I was sent to a little town called Baumholder, Germany, and I spent 13 months there as a rifle platoon leader in a mechanized platoon.
Okay.
And then was transferred for the last 4 or 5 months of my 2 years to Berlin.
All right. And how did you first become involved with the military service?
Well, I never knew whether I was going to be a soldier or not, except World War II affected me a lot. I saw people coming back from that war when I was young, and that very impressive people who came back. And an older brother, when he went to college, he was the first person in my family to go to college, and he immediately joined ROTC, and that was in 1954. When I went to college in 1956, I decided if my older brother was going to be an Army officer, by gosh, I was too. So I immediately wanted to be in ROTC and wanted to serve my country that way.
Okay. Well, why don't you just go ahead and give us some idea of what your military service was like, what the things that transpired and so forth, things that you remember.
Okay. I probably should start a little bit by telling you that when I first got into ROTC, I was not a very serious person at it, and probably was down near the bottom of my class until I was involved in an automobile accident, which made me grow up very quickly. And I realized that maybe the cadre and the ROTC unit didn't think very much of me, but when I recovered from the accident, I decided I was going to take that more seriously. And to make a long story short, by the time I graduated, I was in charge of a company in the ROTC and had come in first in the ROTC summer camp at Fort Knox. So I had done a total turnaround because of an accident that happens in your life. When I went on active duty at Fort Benning in May of 61, it was about 5 days before Alan Shepard went up in the spacecraft. I decided, again, I was going to take that very seriously, and in a class of about 72 or 73 people, I came in first or second. I don't remember exactly which, but I took it very seriously. I was trying to do the best I could do. After that, I was assigned to stay at Fort Benning and be part of the aggressor force. Somebody has to put on those problems for all those training units that come through. I was assigned as a platoon leader to an aggressor company, and so for 3 or 4 months, I set up aggressor-type activities for the Ranger School, for the Infantry School, and I did that fairly aggressively until I got my orders to go to Berlin in September, about 5 or 6 months after I'd gotten into the Army. So immediately my direction shifted from Fort Benning. I was leaving the States, and I was going to Germany to serve there.
Now, what weapons had you qualified in by that time?
45 caliber pistol, M1 rifle, that's all. But I was a fairly decent shot, but I was, those are the only two. Typical infantry weapons. I was what the Army called a 1542. That was my MOS, which was a small unit platoon leader.
Okay. So then, from Fort Benning, That's where you got assigned to Berlin?
No, I was assigned to Baumholder. There was Baumholder, Germany is about 80 miles southwest of Frankfurt. And it's a little town. When I told people I was going to Baumholder, they just laughed and said, you're going to hate it there. You're going to be there with about, I said, am I going to meet a lot of German people? They said, no, you're going to meet about 1,000 German people and about 10,000 GIs. And I thought, well, okay, that's going to be my lot, I guess. So when I got to Berlin, I was assigned rifle company platoon leader for A Company, 1st Platoon of the 16th Infantry. One of the first, and even though a crisis was going on in Berlin at that time, my unit was involved at that moment with helping 20th Century Fox film the movie The Longest Day on the coast of France. My company commander, a black man named Willie McBee, who I thought the world of, asked me, first question he asked me was, are you married, Lieutenant? And I said, no, sir, I'm single. He said, you are the only single officer that I have working under me, and therefore you get to go to the Atlantic Ocean and splash in the ocean with 20th Century Fox.
So you were actually in the movie?
My troops were. I tried very hard to stay out of the role that involved lying in the sand for hours at a time. But my platoon was in the movie, and I got to meet people like Daryl Zanuck and Robert Mitchum and Eddie Albert and Jeffrey Hunter and a number of others. But we did that for 2 or 3 weeks, very shortly after I got to Europe.
Very interesting duty, huh?
It was interesting. One of the things I discovered from the time I got involved with the military is people always said, don't volunteer for anything, and I found that to be terrible advice. I always volunteered for everything. Some of the best things that happened to me happened because I volunteered.
Very good. So how long did it take them to shoot the movie, the part that you were involved in?
The part that I was involved was about 3 weeks. And we actually did the landing, if you see in the movie, when Eddie Albert runs off the landing craft on Omaha Beach, I run off right behind him. That's the only time I was actually in the movie, but you don't recognize it as being me. But we shot the landing scenes on Omaha Beach, and it took about 2 to 3 weeks. We were doing it with British soldiers, French soldiers, and American soldiers. We had my battle group had 5 platoons there. One of those 5 platoons was mine.
And were your soldiers in your platoon, were they pretty excited about doing this?
Oh,
group?
Yeah, they were. Yeah. And the reason that the 20th Century Fox asked us is that the 16th Infantry was actually involved in the Omaha Beach landing on D-Day. And so
how appropriate.
We could authentically have the right patches on.
Sure.
Everything we had on was the right stuff.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And then now, once the movie was completed, then
it was back to Baumholder and back to the drudgery of being in the army in a cold place in Germany. I have to tell you, I've told you earlier that World War II sort of pulled at me quite a lot when I was young. One of the first things I looked for as I was riding around Germany in either my private car or in my armored personnel carrier was to. In 1961, you could still see damage to buildings. You could still see bullet holes as you rounded corners into these little towns. And so you saw a lot of that. The 16th Infantry had a relationship, special relationship, with a little town in Belgium called Edelbrook. And I was involved in going to Edelbrook on the first spring that I was there. And I was sitting in a little bar at Edelbrook, and I noticed that there was a poster of a big poster-sized photograph of a soldier on the bar. I noticed that he looked familiar, and I asked the bartender, I said, who is that? And he said, you don't know who that is? I said, no. He said, that's your S3. That's Sergeant McCluskey to us. He's Major McCluskey to you. And I said, what is the significance of the picture? He said, when we were liberated in 1944, he was the first soldier walking into this town. Hmm. So that's a picture of Sergeant Joe McCluskey walking into Edelbrook, Luxembourg, and being part of the Liberation Force. He's a famous guy in our town.
I didn't know.
So it was interesting to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
talk to people who actually knew him when he was walking through there in World War II.
Now, when you were in the bomb holder, did you participate in any war game activities?
Oh, yeah, quite a lot. One of the interesting things was that because of my experience I'd had at Fort Benning of being an aggressor, anytime we went out on a field problem, my platoon was chosen to be the aggressor. And I have to say, and this is bragging a little bit on my platoon, we had a problem that was going to be a 2 or 3 day problem. And I was told to just raise hell with the friendly forces. I was the enemy. I was the guy, you know, who was from the wrong country and everybody's supposed to hate. Uh-huh. Do what you can to disrupt what we're doing. Well, I knew how to do that. And what we did was we didn't go to bed. We slept in the daytime. And so when we thought everybody else was going to bed at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, we got up and we did our thing. And one of the things we did one night, within about 2 hours, let me digress a second. This was a division exercise. Every division has something called the LRRP, the Long Range Reconnaissance Patrol. Sure. Our LRRP was a group of about 50 people. I was able to, with my platoon, to capture that entire force of 50 people by doing it in the middle of the night. And once we captured them, we went in and captured the division headquarters. We were not very popular the next day. But it was only because I had been trained at Fort Benning how to set up problems and how to get under the enemy's skin at the maximum level. Another time I just had a senior moment. I'll think of it in a minute. Another time when that came in handy. Of how field problems are set up for the opposing force when you're in a training situation. Annually, we had something called the ATT, the Annual Training Test. And my platoon, out of 15 platoons in our battle group, came in first. And it probably came in first only because I would ride into these situations in the APC, and I would say to myself, this looked like a perfect place for an ambush. If I were setting up this problem, I would set up the ambush right here. I would slow down our troops, deploy them out into the woods on the side. And everybody assumed I was cheating. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't. I was just looking at the problem. I was thinking outside the box from what other people were doing. So I had to withstand all kinds of accusations of, you knew what the problem was. Well, no, I didn't, but I recognized the situation. And it was only because I'd had exposure to the other side. Mm-hmm. So that aggressor training at Fort Benning came in handy more than once.
Okay, then, was there anything else significant at bomb holder that you think we...
I was not a rifle platoon leader very long before somebody wanted to make me the assault weapons platoon leader. And assault weapons platoon leader, at the time, we had two weapons. And this was a platoon that supported an entire five companies. And our size of the assault weapons platoon was about 40 people and had about four or five little teams running around with... I was talking about the assault weapons platoon, and I wanted to say that we had two weapons. One weapon was called the SS-10 missile. The SS-10 was a French-made missile that could shoot about 1,000 meters, and what made it unusual was that when you shot the missile, you shot it from a ground-level tripod, and it trailed a wire out behind it, and also had a flare burning at the back of the missile so that the gunner, who was lying on the ground in a prone position with a joystick, would actually fly the missile into the target, because he could see the target, he could see the back of his missile, and no matter how far away it got, he could still see that little dot of light. And every time we fired one of those suckers, it was $700, so we didn't get to fire very many. The other weapon we had was called a SPAT, self-propelled anti-tank weapon. It was a small tank, probably about this halfway between a Jeep size and a good-sized truck. But it was a tracked vehicle, and it was supposed to sneak around under the bushes with a two-man crew and blow holes in the side of other tanks. So very unusual weapon to have at the battalion level or battle group level. And I was in charge of that for a little while. And that was my last assignment before I actually was transferred to Berlin.
These SPATs, did the Army have a lot of those? Or?
Not very many. I would say, every battle group had two or three.
Uh-huh.
There weren't very many.
See.
Another interesting weapon I was introduced to at that point in time, and you guys may have heard of this, is the Davy Crockett missile.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the Davy Crockett was a small nuclear missile that was fired off the back of the Jeep, and it had a range of about 5 kilometers and would theoretically kill anything within about a 500-yard radius. I was actually trained on that because they thought they were going to assign it to an assault weapons platoon, but they did not. But every time I hear about little clusters of radical Islamic people huddled in the sand right now, think of the Davy Crockett missile and wish we'd fire a few of those. Probably could knock out a few.
That was actually a nuclear weapon.
It was a nuclear weapon.
Not an arm.
And it was used at the division level and maybe one level smaller than the division. But if you Google Davy Crockett missile, you'll get some information on it.
Okay.
They declassified it.
And then from bomb holder.
Well, what happened, I decided I'd had enough of bomb holder. And I was getting within about 6 months of the end of my 24 months. And I put in for a transfer to go to Berlin, never dreaming that they would accept it. But it was accepted, and probably the reason it was accepted was that there was an operation that went on every 3 months in Europe at that time where a new battle group would be sent from Fort Riley or Kansas or someplace else. It would rotate into Berlin, and another unit would rotate out of Berlin, and they would constantly replace a battle group in Berlin. And there was going to be one going home about the same time I was going home. So they decided it would make sense to transfer me to Berlin, assign me to that unit, and then I could go home with a whole bunch of people from Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. Anyway, that was the theory. But when I got to Berlin, I discovered, just by pure accident, that my S3 was the officer who was responsible for assigning Checkpoint Charlie officers in charge. And when I heard that, I decided I wanted that job. And so I went in and I told him the first or second day I was there, I told him that I was very interested if he had an opening on the Checkpoint Charlie duty. I would love to have it. He sort of looked at me funny, like, what would qualify you to do that? And so I told him all the things I had done up to that point, including some of the ROTC stuff, including some of the things I had done in bomb holder. And he said, I'll let you know the next day. So he called me in the next day, and he said, okay, Lieutenant, you got it. Well, by that time, I was a first lieutenant, and it was a first lieutenant job, so I wasn't applying for anything that was over my head. So from that point forward, until I left Berlin to come home, I was one of three officers assigned to be on-site running Checkpoint Charlie. Now, we reported back to him at brigade headquarters, but what we did at the checkpoint, with rotating between three officers, you worked 12 hours and then you were off for 24 hours. Then you worked 12 and you were off 24. They were terrible work hours and, bad on your sleep.
Yeah.
but I wanted to do it because I wanted the experience. I wanted to say that I had done that. And so for that brief period of time of 4 months, I was, you know, if there was a Cold War, if the Cold War had a ground zero, I was standing at it every other day. And the setup at the checkpoint was, it was manned with military police for the most part. And usually six or eight per shift, and they worked on 8 hour shifts, so they their schedule was very different from ours. And also there was a West Berlin policeman assigned to us to be a translator, and I can't remember the name of my translator. He was a very nice man. I asked him one day how old he was, and he said he was 46 in perfect English. And I asked him, where did you learn to speak such beautiful English? And he said, in a POW camp in the middle of Kansas. And he said, I said, were we good to you? He said, yeah, good enough.
Let me ask you, Jim. I'm trying to recollect in my memory about the history of the time period. Was the Berlin airlift completed at that time?
Oh, yeah. Okay. The Berlin airlift was really in 1948.
It was
10 years before.
Okay.
They'd already had time to build a big memorial at the main Tempelhof Airport in Berlin. It's a big, tall thing that most people call a fork. It looks like a fork, but since we lost 29 flyers flying supplies into there in 1948, the Berlin people decided they'd better have a memorial. And so it still sits there today. Again, if you were to be on Google Earth and you look at Tempelhof Airport, you'll eventually come across that sort of curved fork that sticks about 50 feet up in the air.
Okay. Well, when you were assigned to Checkpoint Charlie, were there some unusual or significant incidents that you had to deal with?
Yes and no. Were they big? Probably not in the history of the whole checkpoint. We had let me tell you a little bit about what the rules were in Berlin. The American forces tried to prove on an hourly basis that Americans could go anywhere in Berlin they wanted to go. So every hour, a patrol of uniformed Americans would ride through Checkpoint Charlie and into East Berlin, and they would ride around in there and go wherever they wanted to, and then ride back out. And then another patrol, different people, would ride in the next hour. This was done 24 hours a day. Because the Russians were trying to say, you can't do this. You know, this is our part of the city. You got to stay out of here. But the four countries who had agreed to separate Berlin the way they did, the French, the British, the Americans, and the Russians, had an agreement that any one of those parties could go anywhere they wanted to in the city. And so the Russians tried to keep us from living up to our part of that bargain, because we pushed the envelope all the time. And that's why we sent those patrols in there. And they were in military police cars with uniforms. It'd be a captain or something would be riding in the shotgun seat, and a PFC for a driver, and a couple of guys in the back seat. But they would ride in. They would, you know, obviously they had their own assignments of where they're supposed to go and what they're supposed to look for and what they're supposed to look at. But every once in a while, they would get too close to something sensitive in East Berlin, and the Russians would block them, would surround them with tanks or trucks and hold them there for a while. Well, one of those incidents happened while I was involved, and I got to work one morning, and I got a call from my commander, and he said, Lieutenant, when General Zhukov rides through the checkpoint this morning on the way from the east to his job at Tempelhof Airport, I want you to stop his car at the checkpoint for 22 minutes. And I said, could you explain that? And he said, well, he stopped our patrol yesterday for 22 minutes. And so I want you to stop him for 22 minutes, block in the car, make sure you know that he can't get through. And after 22 minutes, let him through. If he asks you any questions, don't give him any answers. And so when the general's car came and this NATO green, kind of a clunky looking sedan, rode through there every morning about 8:45. And when he came, we put the barricades up in front, surrounded his car with MPs, standing at parade rest, and just blocked the whole checkpoint. When 22 minutes went by, we let him through. He asked me several times, why was he being held, and I just didn't answer. So that kind of stuff went on all the time. When I was assigned there, there was a shooting at the checkpoint, about a block from the checkpoint, but you could see it from the checkpoint, involving this famous little guy named Peter Fechter. Peter Fechter was trying to escape from the east into the west. He got into something called the death zone. There was a strip of land between two parts of the wall that they had it mined, and they had dogs running up and down it. And it also gave the people who were manning the towers, the soldiers manning the towers, you could shoot people in the back if they saw them in time before they got over the second wall. Well, Peter Fechter got shot in the back. And he fell down, he was 19 years old, he fell down inside the wall on the East Berlin side, and there were enough television cameras around at the time it happened that they actually had a camera trained on him the whole time he was alive. And he died after about 2 hours, but they wouldn't let anybody go to his help, to his aid.
He was a German civilian?
A German civilian, 19 years old. So even today, if you go to Checkpoint Charlie and say, where's the Peter Fechter Memorial? They'll point to a place about 100 yards away where there's always flowers sitting there, where they've made it a little memorial spot.
Yeah.
That happened shortly before I got there. And so at the time I was at Checkpoint, people were always coming and saying, where's the Peter Fechter Memorial? So we'd have to point that out. Another time... and this involves American troops. Americans could go through the checkpoint into East Berlin anytime they wanted to, but we wanted them to be in uniform if they were in the military. And I always had to give a little lecture to the enlisted men, and that was don't do any drinking, don't get out of control while you're on there. Always keep your uniform all buckled up and, looking very good. Well, the hourly patrol came back one day, and the captain said, Lieutenant, you got a drunk GI about 3 blocks in there. And he told me where he was, and so he said, I think you better go get him. And I said, okay. And so I always wore pistol belt and 45, so I didn't want to walk into East Berlin armed. So, I took it off and put it in the safe inside the little office that I had, and then walked in just like any other military person in a Class A uniform, and found the guy, threw 3 blocks in there, almost grabbed him by the ear to drag him out. He was pretty drunk. And got him out, we arrested him, and the reason I tell that story is because the higher-ups were very strict at that point about behavior in Germany. I would say that guy was back in the States in some other unit within 48 hours. They were shipped out of there. I mean, if somebody did something like that, he was gone quick. Another interesting thing I came across when I was in Berlin is that I had a fraternity brother. I had gone to college at William & Mary up in Williamsburg, Virginia, and I had a fraternity brother, and his name was a little guy named Bruiser Camp, Junius Camp. I guess if you're named Junius, Bruiser is not so bad. Anyway, Bruiser Camp was a year or so older than me, and he was a transportation officer, and he was a career officer. He stayed in for 20 years. He would happen to be the guy in charge of the Berlin Motor Pool. And when he heard I was in Berlin, he invited me over to lunch one day when I wasn't working, and he invited me into the motor pool. And what he showed me really amazed me. He was responsible for every military vehicle in Berlin. and there was a central motor pool for all that. He showed me German sedans, but they've been modified for American use. We sent spies into East Berlin on a regular basis, probably two people per car, to go look for whatever they were looking for. You know, they were told to check out certain places, and they might go 500 or 1,000 miles deep away from Berlin into Russia even. But the cars were all modified with 250 to 500 gallon gas tanks occupied the whole back seat. And so he showed me that, and he also showed me some of those same cars had bullet holes in the side. I said, how did that happen? He said, guys got too close to something somewhere in the east, and they got shot at, and they had to hightail it out of there and get back home. So that was that. We'd always been told in Berlin, you know, don't really pal around anybody you don't really know. And after I saw those cars and talked to Bruiser, and he showed me, he gave me some idea of what was going on under the surface, under the radar, that, you know, I think it was good advice. Just make sure you go out drinking at night and balling around with people you already know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you must have suspected that the Russians were probably doing the same thing.
Well, absolutely. One of the interesting things happened when I left. Let me digress a minute. At the checkpoint, we had a ground level operation, but we also had an OP, an observation point. It's in my old story, where we were up on about the fourth floor, just with binoculars, so we could see pretty well into East Berlin. They were always looking back at us. When I was finally ready to leave Berlin, and I was driving my car to Bremerhaven to ship it home, and I was stopped at a checkpoint manned by Russians, and I was asked some really strange questions about, and all I was supposed to do was name, rank, and serial number, you know, it's the usual thing. I was asked some questions by this colonel in the Russian army, and he asked me, how did I like working at the checkpoint? And I said, you know, my name is James B. Osmond, my rank is so and so. And while he was talking to me, he pulled out a drawer, and I could see what he was looking at. He was looking at a telephoto picture of me working at Checkpoint Charlie. And I thought, that's weird.
Yeah.
But I guess I should expect that.
Well, so do you think it's because they recognize you because, or they were tailing you, or they just happened to...
No, I think they just create a file on everybody.
Oh, I see.
I didn't have any particular thing that I could do that anybody else couldn't do. I suspect that the other two guys who worked in Checkpoint, there was a file on them too.
Yeah, probably so.
A picture file, anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. I'm just as happy that the Cold War is now really cold.
Yeah,
But, you know, I want to say, even though I am I'm a veteran of the Army and I'm a veteran of the Cold War, I hold in high esteem those people who came before me doing the real jobs of getting us to the point that we could actually occupy Germany and, you know, see them grow into a good democracy. I realize my part in all that is very incidental, very tangential to the main playing field that was happening. I just happened to come along later and benefit from some of the things they did, and have a good close-up view of the history that they made. And I've always appreciated that. So I don't overblow my role in that at all. I was allowed to stand in a very interesting spot and look at what happened.
Well, there aren't many people that can say that, you know? So we really appreciate the fact that you're sharing that with us. I want to ask you kind of a mundane question. What was the child like at your Bonhoeffer?
Bonhoeffer?
Yeah.
I actually always ate at the officers' club.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Okay, so you didn't have
to
army.
In fact, the rules there were kind of, I don't know how usual this was for they really didn't allow officers and enlisted men to participate in the same eating establishments at all. Uh-huh. We couldn't even go to the USO Club. I wanted a cheeseburger so bad it would just drive me crazy, and finally I got one of the guys in my unit to bring me back a cheeseburger from the USO Club, because there was no place I could go to get one. The Bomb Holder Officers Club was run by German chefs cooking German meals for the most part, and I was just dying for every once in a while just to have a good cheeseburger with lettuce, tomato, and mayonnaise.
I've had that feeling before, too. Well, what about when you were at Checkpoint Charlie, what kind of billeting did you have, and did you also eat at the officers' club there? Or?
Yes and no. I did sometimes, but I was assigned. But let me give you a little more detail about that. The unit I was assigned to in Berlin was the 13th Infantry, and I theoretically I came home with the 13th Infantry. But I really didn't, because when I got detached away from the 13th Infantry and to Checkpoint Charlie, that sort of changed my future by doing that. And so I didn't come home with those guys. I came home alone. I was assigned to a BOQ this is an interesting story, that had been an old hospital in the 30s and 40s, leading up to the power of Hitler. It still had the hospital markings on the front doors and on the gate. We had modified it into a BOQ, and it probably held 50 to 100 officers. I had a room up on the third, very nice room up on the third floor, and there was a restaurant in the basement run by a master sergeant, an American master sergeant. And I'm not quite sure how he was allowed to do that, but I ate most of my meals down there. You'd have things like T-bone steak or hamburgers. Finally got to get back to American food, but there were no German touches on the food there. I've tried to find the building. I've been back to Berlin a couple of times, and I've tried to find the building, and I've about come to the conclusion it was torn down sometime in the 70s. But it was said to be a place of medical experiments in the 30s. You know, when Hitler came to power, it was one of the buildings that he had sort of taken over to allow the doctors to do whatever experiments they were doing on people. And so that was the building, and maybe that's why they tore it down. Maybe it had such an infamous history.
Didn't want to have it.
But I can point on a map in Berlin where it was, but all my contacts just would basically say it's not there anymore. There's a big one-block complex of hospital-type stuff, but it's just not in there. It's been torn down.
Well, so when your tour was up then in Berlin, and you had to come back to the States, what was that like preparing to come back?
Well, I mentioned the part about taking the car to Bremerhaven, but yeah. I had this is hard lessons of being in the Army. I had decided that I wanted to come home with the USS United States, a nice civilian liner, and so I booked the reservation with my orders. And I was good to go as long as somebody who ranked me didn't come along and bump me off. Well, somebody bumped me off. A captain came along who had his family with him, and he said, "Lieutenant, you know, you're not going to go. I'm going to go in your place. My family." So I ended up having to fly home anyway. And I got to Fort Hamilton, New York. And I spent the final 3 days in the Army at Fort Hamilton, New York. And the interesting thing about that was right outside of my window for 3 days, I watched the Verrazano Narrows Bridge being built. It was probably two-thirds of the way completed by then, but there was a little robot-type car that was threading cable from one side of the river to the other, adding to, you know, laying out a quarter-inch cable as it went back and forth. And I watched that go on for 3 days, and it just was continuous, 24 hours a day. And I never knew how they built those things, but they build those big cables that hold up those suspension bridges one little quarter-inch piece at a time.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They run this thing up back and forth, but that was the time that I did that. It was late in April of 1963.
So you mustered out in New York.
Yes.
And then did you go right from there back to Aiken? Or?
No, I was obligated at that moment to go back to my girlfriend.
Oh, okay.
Who I had not seen for a couple of years. She lived in Norfolk, Virginia. I had met her in college. And so I picked up my car, which was a Volkswagen. I had bought a new Volkswagen about a month before I shipped home. And it was waiting for me in the north, someplace in New Jersey. Got the car and jumped in it and drove down the East Coast, literally the East Coast, I-95. I don't think it was finished by then. So I was using the back roads through Delaware and the northern neck of Maryland and Virginia, coming across the Chesapeake Bay to Norfolk. And so I spent 3 or 4 days with her and her family before I actually got in that car and went back to Aiken to see my parents.
So when you did then get back to Aiken, how long was it before you were employed at that time?
About 6 weeks. I had read a magazine article that had a great effect on me. It was a Time magazine article talking about the greatest sales force in the world, and I decided I wanted to be in the greatest sales force in the world. And at that moment, Time magazine thought it was the IBM Corporation, and that if you could get on with IBM selling those great computers, that you'd be home free. So I decided I was going to interview IBM in Virginia, not in South Carolina. So I interviewed, back up a minute, my girlfriend and I decided that we did not want to live in Norfolk, where her mother lived. We did not want to live in South Carolina, where my parents lived, so we had to choose a third site. We chose Richmond, Virginia. So I went to Richmond, interviewed IBM, and I have to tell you that they were ecstatic to hear all my interesting stories from Checkpoint Charlie and The Longest Day and those kind of stories, but I also passed all their tests, was hired, and started working for them on June the 1st, 1963, having been out about a month. And my wife and I got married on June the 8th in Williamsburg, Virginia. And so I told IBM, I said, if you hire me, I'm going to be gone for a week on my honeymoon. So they accepted that. So I really didn't start serious working until mid-June 1963.
And what was your position?
I was a sales trainee / systems engineer. The way IBM did it, and they sort of decide real quick whether you're the sales type they want to put in front of a customer or whether you're the nerdy type they want sitting in the back writing programs. But they make you go through the writing programs part. They want you to know how to do that. So you go through all the training to learn how to write programs and design systems, and then you go through the sales training. But I was earmarked for sales right away. They knew that's where they wanted me, and I think that's where I wanted to be.
So you had then, from that point on, you had a career with IBM?
My work career really consists of 5 7-year stops. Some people have the 7-year itch because of women. I have the 7-year itch because of jobs. I stayed with IBM 7 years and was persuaded to leave by some of my buddies who worked for IBM. We decided to start a new company, and we were going to try to do the same thing Ross Perot had done with electronic data systems. Ross Perot had built this very successful company dealing in facilities management, meaning you go into a big company and you convince top management in that company to turn over their entire data processing department to his company, EDS, and they would run it professionally from the inside. So we decided we wanted to do that. So my second career was at a place called the Computer Company. I was one of the co-founders. It was in Richmond. And after 7 years of that, we had made it a success. We started with 7 guys. By the time I left, it had about 1,000 employees and was doing about $35 million, but it wasn't doing what we wanted to do. what I wanted to do. It was processing claims for Medicaid for 8 states or something like that. Totally different from what we set out to do. So I was persuaded to leave that by a friend who was at the time the executive vice president of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Virginia. He needed a new data processing officer to run the whole data processing department of about 600 people. And so he recruited me, and I went and stayed with them for 6.5, 7 years. I discovered in that time I really didn't like the healthcare business. I remember asking him one day, who do we work for? Do we work for the doctor or the hospital or the subscriber? And he gave me the worst answer possible. He said, well, in a way, we work for all three. And I thought, how can we possibly succeed if we work for all? Then we got to give different stories to three different parties. And that was pretty much, that's pretty much a story of Blue Crosses all over the country, even today. I left that and bought a printing company and in Richmond, and I operated that printing company for 6-7 years. And what made me sell it, I had grown it 4 times its size in that 6 or 7 years. What made me sell it was I started having blackouts. I think I mentioned to you earlier that I had a pacemaker. I am now on my 3rd pacemaker. What makes you black out is that your heart stops beating and the blood and oxygen no longer get into your brain. You black out. I felt like I was about to die. This was in 1990. And that I had to sell this company so that my wife didn't want to operate. And so I sold the company and basically retired at age 51. But found out 6 weeks later that I could be cured. My blackouts would stop if I had a pacemaker. So they slapped a pacemaker in me. And I said, I'm now on my 3rd, but they last about 7 years. And so within 2 months after I sold the company, I basically needed a job. And my father, gets complicated. My father had started a company in Augusta, Georgia, when he was 82 years old, in about 1984. He had, one of my brothers was running it with him, and then my father died in 86, and my brother was, this was a pretty good idea for a company, and my brother was floundering around with it and trying to make it successful, and by this time my mother died, and so suddenly the 5 children in my family that I grew up in owned this company that was struggling, and one brother was running it and not doing very well. And so the other brothers and sister pounced on me because of some of the work experience I had that he hadn't had, pounced on me to go to Augusta and help Julian run the company. And I resisted at first. I didn't want to do it because I realized I was getting into his game late and, you know, probably wasn't the best idea. Well, I did. I allowed them to prevail, so 4 months after I had the new pacemaker, I was in the car on the way to Augusta to live what I thought was going to be 6 months. We were in negotiations at that point to sell the company to Bristol Myers. And it was a small company, but it was an idea they were interested in. Anyway, I got down there and we realized that Bristol Myers was semi-serious, but it wasn't going to be 6 months. It was going to be more like a year. So I had family meetings with my wife and my children, and basically I decided to, I told Julian, my brother, I said, I'm here for the duration, however long that takes, but we got to heal this company and make it healthy, and then we can sell it. Right now it's not good enough to sell. And so, make a long story short, I was there 7 years too, and we sold the company, and we sold it, we sold it at the very end of 1996 for several million dollars. And the 5 of us who owned it were all able to retire. Mm-hmm. So, and it was one of those this is where I have to be very careful how I say it. Sometimes you're the one who's in the right place at the right time with the right information. Mm-hmm. And that particular time, that happened to be me. I had the computer background. I had the medical background with Blue Cross Blue Shield. I had the printing background. I had management experience background. I had been involved in selling companies at the time. I was in the computer stage of the second stage. And so I had done almost all of the things that needed to be done, and my brother hadn't done any of them. And so he's a pretty religious guy, and he says, you know, sometimes God just sends you what you need. He said, that's how I look at your role in this company. He says,
so in this
you
case,
showed up at the right time.
It was you.
I showed up at the right time for what he needed. And then, yeah, in this case, it was me.
So once you sold the company then?
And totally did not work another day.
So you retired at that
yeah,
point?
Yeah, retired in 1997.
Well, then what brought you to Amelia Island?
Tax laws. I was considered a resident of Georgia and Virginia. I still had a home in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And both of them wanted to tax me 6 or 7% for what my proceeds were from selling that company. I was able to quickly establish a residence in Florida. I told my wife when I got in the car in Augusta, and she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to drive to Yulee and buy a double wide and call it home. And she said, no, you're not. So I did go to Amelia Island because I'd been here before, back in the 80s. I'd been here on a business trip for Blue Cross. And I was able to buy my first condominium on Amelia Island just with the tax I saved from not being a Georgia resident.
Wow.
So that's how strong the tax laws of Florida are to get you to here rather than sit there and pay them a state tax of 6 or 7%.
So what year was that?
1997. I became a Florida resident in March the 29th of 1997.
So about 11 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So what are you doing with your time now?
Be careful what you ask for. back when I was in 76, I wrote a book called The Silver Dollar Encyclopedia. And then by 79, I decided to write that again because I looked at the first one and I didn't like it very much. And so I rewrote it in 79 into a much better book. That's a long way of saying I wrote two books 30 years ago. But I promised myself at the time, if I ever get to where I could do it, I'm going to write another book and it's going to be fiction. So the last few months I have finished writing a fiction book that I'm going to self-publish. You know, 100 copies will go to friends and family, and that's it. Just to live up to my promise to myself.
Is this historical fiction or?
Fantasy.
Fantasy.
If you know what fantasy is, Brigadoon, mm-hmm. Big, Tom Hanks movie where he dances on the piano.
Sure.
All of the Narnia stories are fantasy. I like to take real life and just sort of twist it just enough to make it interesting. I found that I was a pretty lazy writer. I based most of the characters on people in my family just because it was easier to do that than to go create something that you then had to remember. You know, you can remember your son and
sure.
What his background is. You just take his background and twist it into a little character off to the side.
So did you get involved in the Book Island Festival?
No, nobody knows yet that I've done this. I'm still mulling around whether I'm going to tell anybody.
So that's a future thing.
Yeah.
Well,
at 70 years old, how optimistic are you supposed to be? I'm not sure.
Well, you probably have a better look at reality now than maybe as you were developing. Well, Jim, I want to thank you for taking the time with us. I also want to thank you for your service to your country. We really do appreciate it. And this concludes the interview with James B. Osmond.